Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Brainwaves, hear the world differently. Bringing community mental health to you, raising awareness and challenging stigma. Tune in to 3CR Community Radio, Wednesdays at 5pm.
Melbourne's Drive Time Radio program, featuring community organisations, powerful stories and information. Find us at brainwaves.org.au. Proudly sponsored by Wellways Australia.
I would like to begin by paying my respects to the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which I am coming to you from today. Land where at Brainwaves we tell our stories, and land where the traditional custodians have told their stories for many, many years before us, and continue to tell their stories. I would like to pay my respects to Elders past and present, and acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners who are listening today.
Hello and welcome to Brainwaves on 3CR 855am, 3CR Digital Radio, and online at 3cr.com.au. I'm Mark, and tonight we'll be playing part two of our interview with artists Professor Ken Wilder and Dr. Aaron McPeak. We recently caught up with them to talk about the Beyond the Visual exhibition, which they both curated. Beyond the Visual is an exhibition developed in close collaboration with blind and partially blind artists, curators and audiences. The curators hope that the exhibition will inspire institutional change and pave the way for galleries and museums to follow its example, redefining what galleries can be.
There was an artist I worked with a number of years ago, exhibited with, who's blind, Hugh Huddy, and he makes the point about sound, being able to identify whether a lamppost is sheet metal, cast metal, or timber, or if it's a tree. Is it a big tree or a small tree? Is it a metal door? Is it an expensive metal door? Is it a timber door? Just through the acoustic, just by walking past. And I say, oh, wow, like you, that, you're amazing. And it's like, well, no. You can do it. Anyone can do it. You just have to, and the example he gave me was take some recordings, take them home and listen to them, and you will hear that difference. So it's about that kind of opening things up. You know, as Ken was saying about his skylights work with opening up, you walk into this, what was a paint store, is a ceramic walled building with water, and suddenly you're hearing these trees and getting these shafts alike, which if you can't see, you're going to get the temperature of the light, the radiation of the light hitting you. So, you know, we're really just trying to open that up to get people to think about and consider those things more generally when they're encountering things. And that can be, it's not about blindness or artwork made by blind people or kind of encouraged to be, experienced by blind people. This is for anything.
And it keys into aspects such as death space, you know, the notion that if someone's signing, you need more space, you need spaces to gather, you need spaces to be able to step back and see someone signing. So you need wider corridors, you need corners that are kind of, you know, not sharp, so you can see someone coming before, you know. So I think it keys into kind of other aspects of so-called universal design, you know, that actually having space that exploits kind of changes in height, so that the sound changes, also keys into aspects of deaf space, but it also makes buildings generally more kind of, so I think everyone gains from that, rather than these kind of claustrophobic buildings that are very tight in terms of kind of space. So I think, you know, opening up to those kind of sensory engagements deals not just with blindness but with other kind of disabilities as well. And I, you know, that there's a gain for everyone.
How do we discuss art that is produced in this way? From what I understand, when we usually talk about, we might use terms like color, shape, or form, or line to when we're discussing it. How would we talk about, you know, what kind of language do we use to talk about art that is displayed at Beyond the Visual?
Well, we're having lots of fun exploring that and playing with that and working with a number of audio describers, both in with the moving image or with screen-based imagery, but also in the gallery space and with writers as well. So there is no the I think from my perspective, the kind of end of the last century audio description was very dry. Just I couldn't it can't bear to listen to it, frankly. But it was sort of there is a and on the left there is. Whereas what we're trying to do, and again there's no right answer, but you know, a 9-year-old will deliver a knockout punch that will be unforgettable for the rest of your life. So there is no simple straight answer, and we think that the discussion about that, and hopefully during the exhibition we'll be making co-created audio descriptions with visitors and with specifically with blind groups, with general public, with children, with educational projects. We're going to be compiling a set of descriptions of the work, which hopefully we'll be able to make available to other visitors. As part, we have audio descriptions made by the artists when they're alive, and then there'll be audio descriptions made by third parties, and then we will have a series or a kind of a an accumulating set of co-created audio descriptions. So there is no right answer, and that's something we're exploring. And in itself, it's almost could be described as an art form. I think Ken probably has something to
Yeah,
add with that.
interesting.
We're working very closely with Sally Booth, who's a very experienced audio describer who's blind herself, and Joseph Rizzo-Naldi, who's a blind writer. And something also the kind of professor in French and Disability Studies, is that right? Hannah
Yes,
Thompson.
French literature, yeah.
The Royal Holloway, Hannah Thompson, she always says that, who's partially blind herself, she says that, you know, what we want to do really is to get everyone, including the sighted, interested in ways of we talk about work and we describe work, you know. So it's a shift from audio description simply being a facility just for people that are blind or partially blind, and something where it becomes something that becomes about engaging ideas through language about art. So it's expanding that range of possibilities in which we talk about kind of art practice, and a shifting from, as Aaron said, this very kind of so-called objective, which is never really objective, you know, but objective facts about the work, to something that actually celebrates our lived experience of interacting with artwork. And I think that's kind of again fundamental, and it's opening up new language, you know, new ways of thinking. You know, we have to be really clever about opening up new ways of describing. So Joe Rizzo-Naldi is going to be working very closely with all the artists in the exhibition in order to help them to arrive at rich descriptions of their own practice.
And you sort of went into this before, but I'm curious how is art displayed and, you know, placed in a gallery compared to, you know, the type of artwork that you are presenting to the public? How do we display that compared to how you know, artwork that is, you know, designed to be looked at solely. What kind of considerations had to go into that process?
We've got a number of kind of accessibility features, but we don't want to kind of narrowly describe them just in terms of accessibility. We're kind of in a way turning on its head the thing you often get in galleries where you get a little strip on the floor or coloured tape on the floor that says "Do not enter." And rather than doing that, we've got a change in floor surface, which you can pick up with a white stick, you can pick up underfoot, which is using a kind of matting where if you feel that underfoot, you know that if you reach out, you can touch the artwork. So it's a kind of invitation to touch, to invitation to put your hands out. It's telling you that it's there so you don't fall over it, but it's also this kind of turning a device that's used to exclude into the device that's used to kind of invite you into this kind of much more kind of intimate engagement with the work. So that's, I think, one fundamental difference that we're using. And we're also then using a similar but different device, which is a series of these yellow circles, which again will have a softer feel underfoot on the hard concrete floor in the gallery, which is where all the audio descriptions and the information is going to be. It's going to be in large print. Large print, it's going to be in Braille. There's going to be QR code for those that can use smartphones. But there's also a Braille number that tells you we're going to be giving out a headsets, a hand and headsets for people that aren't able to use a smartphone. And that will then access the descriptions. You know, often Braille is put up, but no one knows it's there. So we're trying to give devices that just kind of, in a way, again, are an invitation to kind of I exchange.
Yes, and also I think what we're doing, which hopefully will be kind of become a contagion, is that we're spending quite a bit of resources and on the front of house staff, the docents or gallery attendants, who in many cases in many institutions are people that sit in chairs looking very glum and bored. But what we're doing with the team at the Henry Moore Institute is training the docents in terms of how to guide, how to speak, how to engage with people with the visual impairments or blindness or mobility issues. But further than that is how to engage with the art. And also that they will become experts in the artworks and the artists, so they will have a kind of a be able to deliver a lecture on all of the pieces and give a bit of background about the artists as well. So they'll be able to discuss things and engage with beholders in ways that is basically, I think, is quite new and groundbreaking, certainly in the UK.
Involving those people in the whole audio description process enriches their language and makes their job much more kind of interesting. So yeah, I think that's kind of really, really important. I was going to say something else, but it's completely gone. But maybe we can come back to that if it suddenly pops back into my
Yeah,
mind.
just to mention it when if it pops in, yeah, just go for it. I am wondering,
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I've
oh
just
yeah,
remembered
please, please go.
that. It's just to say that, if you engage with artwork through touch, there are temporal consequences for that. It takes more time. You need to spend time with works. So I think one of the differences people perhaps will notice that we've limited the number of artworks and encourage people to stay with those artworks for much longer. So rather than having a quick 5 second look at a painting and going on to another one, and these blockbuster exhibitions where you just get work after work after work, and everyone gets exhausted. Everyone gets exhausted. We've limited deliberately the number of artworks to allow people to spend more time with them, and as a result of that, we've also got much more seating in our exhibitions than there normally is. Where, I think, people need time to rest and to think and to take in the descriptions, etc. So that's going to be really important. You can sit down on a stool or on a bench and listen to the audio description. You don't have to kind of move on, and you don't have to wait around for a seat to kind of become apparent, because everyone's hogging the seat because there's so few of them in the gallery space. So we're trying to fundamentally change, the way we think about galleries. They should be much more kind of relaxing and chilled, and give you that time to really stay with the work.
And so you found, oh, pardon me, sorry. And I was just wondering,
No,
so.
just if I had my way, it would be chaise longues as well as seats that you could actually lie down and have a nap.
That would be
Running
nice. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was just wondering. So you found that just by limiting the number of artworks that people can interact with, that did it encourage people to really sort of stay with it and actually explore it for longer than they would other types of artwork.
I mean, we haven't opened yet, but we're hoping that's what will happen. But
Yeah, all right.
we experienced it in other exhibitions. Aaron and I went on a little research trip to an exhibition that's been touring various museums in France. I think it's called Please Touch,
Please touch.
the exhibition, which were a series. They weren't original artworks, there were a series of facsimiles of mainly sculptures from various French collections, but very good copies. I mean, these they tried really hard to actually replicate not only the visual look of the material but also its touch. So it's true to the kind of temperature changes, etc. And it was fantastic in that we were there for some time just watching people engage with the work, and people did spend an awful long time. They were really happy to be there, 5, 10 minutes on one object, and observing that. Was great because it gave us confidence that this is an approach where if people are offered that opportunity, they're really kind of hungry to take that up.
I'd say
I'm
that there's this like cultural shift as well. I recently, in September, I had an exhibition in Burgundy in France, and most of my work is bell bronze sculptures, which ring. They're like bells or gongs, objects that can be struck and rung. But I was really taken after Ken and I had visited the Please Touch exhibition in Nantes. I was really taken by how differently the public engaged with the works. They were much more considered, and so there, I think there are cultural differences in with between audiences that hopefully we're going to be able to discover as we expand and begin to take over the world and its
And
curatorial practices.
it's also not a fact that actually it is about kind of educating people in the possibilities, because we it's not a free for all where we're not presenting a fairground where we people want go completely crazy, start headbutting Aaron's bronze pieces, which has happened elsewhere. People, some, it's not all or nothing. It's not suddenly, we want people to do whatever they want with the works, because some of the works are still kind of, valuable. They have to be handled with care. So it's teaching people those skills about how you can engage through touch without being turning it into some kind of fairground where you can go completely crazy and throw these objects around the space. And again, the working very closely with the gallery assistants, the docents, is important to establishing those new ways about how to behave in galleries that are interactive, but that just doesn't mean a complete free fall.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see how someone who, regular gallery goer might respond if they might feel like they're doing something wrong, 'cause kind of breaking a taboo, a cultural norm in a way, and I guess that's kind of the point as well.
I had an exhibition in MIMA, which had a number of pieces that could be touched and struck. And this is in the Middelsbrunn Institute of Modern Art. So there were eight gong bell pieces and three paintings, if in inverted commas, but the bronzes, but again, they can be touched and they make a sound. And I had a very old friend I hadn't seen since the 90s, and she I was to meet at the gallery, and my train was a bit late, so she'd got there early. But she'd confessed to being too afraid to strike them, which was very interesting, because I'd had said, "Oh, if you get there before me, just go ahead and have a bash, and I'd be interested to hear what you when I when I if I'm not there, it'd be good to hear what your thoughts and say." I couldn't bring myself to hit them. It just felt wrong. So there is some reluctance, I'm sure.
Ben DeVee, who is a kind of Melbourne-based artist who's has a work in the sort of fantastic multi-century work that engages sound, etc., working with a kind of with Georgina Cliche, Hilary Gardell. This is a work which documents Georgina Cliche's interaction with the big Richard Serra Corten Steel pieces, one of those massive pieces in a gallery in San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. And they've taken sound recordings of that interaction. There's a kind of audio description of by Georgina. There's a series of images of close-ups of the Sarah by Hilary Gardell, which Fane's kind of coordinating, and then there's a whole audio description of that. So this is this kind of completely kind of interactive kind of environment. But Fane, in one of her earlier works, displayed in Australia, said she was horrified when she had these works that could be touched, these granite pieces that could be touched, and it ended up it was only blind and partially blind people touching it, so it became a kind of spectacle. And so that's something that she's been very aware of trying to kind of overcome. I think we're doing it. I think we're going to be overcoming that in this exhibition, because every work can be touched. So it's not like suddenly going into a single gallery within, a large museum where suddenly you're offered that chance to touch. When you enter into the building, every single work can be engaged with in that kind of multi-century way. So I think that really kind of helps. And I think getting the kind of docents, the researchers, again, we talked quite a lot about that, but getting them to really encourage people to say, look, you can touch, you can interact, you can hit this object and make a sound, and that's absolutely what we want. So, but I think it'll take time, and it's establishing this new culture about how you behave in gallery spaces. But we hope that that extends beyond the remit of the project.
When I was reading about the exhibition and the way some of the art is interacted with the hands, I was reminded of the cortical and sensory homunculus. For those not aware, the cortical homunculus is a type of diagram that illustrates the human body, except certain parts are exaggerated in size to illustrate the amount of brain and sensory information utilized by them. For example, the figure has these comically gigantic hands and fingers to express the immense amount of cortical and sensory power that's dedicated to them. Considering the disproportionate cerebral and sensory information that's dedicated to our hands, hands are pretty important. But in spite of this, touch has been pretty neglected in art, I'm learning. And why do you think that might be?
There are kind of exceptions. The English art critic Herbert Read in the 1950s wrote a book where he included a sculpture made by someone that was blind that again had quite large hands to make the point of a haptic sensibility. And he argued that the kind of sculpture was a space that you could be described as touch space as opposed to painting, which he called sight space. And he set up this kind of dynamic between the two of them. And he felt that the tactile engagement with sculpture was the key one over and above kind of vision. And he was very influential with people like Henry Moore and Barbara Hepworth, who were both very keen that people would touch the work as well as seeing them. He was kind of marginalized in a way. Some of the kind of American critics like Clement Greene, the great critic, famous American critic, Clement Greenberg mocked Herbert Read's kind of emphasis on touch, arguing that sculpture was in fact all about kind of vision. So there were earlier debates, and in a way, Read lost out in a way to the kind of ocuocentrism of Clement Greenberg, in a way that reduced sculpture to just one of sight. So it's happened before. But it goes back to, again, I think we're now at a very interesting juncture, because everyone's way of gauging with contemporary art has changed really in the last kind of 20 odd years. I mean, I remember when Tate Modern first opened in London, it was extraordinary that suddenly contemporary art, which was always being ridiculed in the public and in the, you know, the right wing press such as the Daily Mail, etc., these bricks are art, what a joke, suddenly a whole set of younger people were flooding into galleries like Tate Modern, engaging with kind of artwork and a willingness to engage, and particularly installation art or performance art or collaborative art that involved, you had to kind of interact with it. So there was this kind of real desire to open up in a way. And so I think we're building on those opportunities, but actually gearing that towards the discussion about blindness and partially blindness, because we can build upon that and specifically start to say, well, yes, this opens up this new kind of grammar of how we behave and how we respond using all our senses.
Yes, and the point you're making about that, the diagram, whose name I can't remember and probably couldn't pronounce at this time, but I would contest that the hands being these enormous things, the feet. I'm a person that wears kind of quite hikey boot type footwear, a very outdoors footwear, or often protective steel-toe-capped working boots. But I make the point that you can actually feel what's underfoot, whether it's expensive wood, whether it's cheap wood, whether it's synthetic carpet, whether it's woolen carpet, whether it's very high-quality oriental carpet. So the feet are, even with boots on, are incredibly sensitive. So I'd contest the hands being the dominant. And in fact, if you want to get really sensitive, I mean, geologists decide on how they grade soil by biting it. So your teeth are, in fact, the most sensitive thing. And if you want to look at a baby, how does it explore anything? It sticks it in its mouth. So I would contest that diagram. It's a long time since I've seen it, but I would contest the kind of the value of that. Okay, the hands are the things. I mean, having the forefinger and opposing thumb, it is the, you know, it is what makes us technologically so good at making tools. But I would contest that the hands are just as, you know, they're great for that because of the opposing thumb finger. But I think there's a lot more going on in the touch. And I think the forearm, the inside of the soft skin of your forearm, again, incredibly, if you want to measure the bath temperature for a child, you put your elbow in. So there is a whole lot of other stuff going on that we don't consider.
I think that, there's people like Matthew Farquharson that's written The Philosophy of Touch, and his research, I mean, the hands are important. I mean, we're not saying that. And in terms of sculpture, the way we palpate an object, the way we feel its temperature, etc., the hands are definitely involved in there. The softness, we run our hands, we can pick up marks of the artist's, the maker's marks much better with the hand than we can through sight. We can, we can feel things that we can't see. But Farquharson makes the point that the cutaneous touch through the hands is only one aspect of touch. There's other aspects of touch, such as kinesthesia, aware of our movements, our internal awareness of how we move our body, and also proprioception, where we are in space. It goes back to this notion of the 360-degree awareness rather than the frontality of vision. We know where our bodies are, space, and sculptures and other artworks. They not only engage us through the hand, but they through full body engagement. They move us in space. We have to move our bodies to go around a kind of art object. So it's again, rather than setting up binaries. I mean, that was a bit of the problem with Herbert Reed, setting up this binary opposition between between touch and sight. We're actually saying, this is again a multi-sensory, full bodily engagement. Artworks are things that are really special because they involved our bodies in a way that we don't, we don't, we're not often aware of that. The Richard Serra, we talked about Richard Serra's big metal pieces. I mean, whenever I see a Richard Serra piece, it also hits me in the pit of the stomach because there's something about these massive pieces of metal that somehow affect me directly, in my digestion. My stomach starts to move in funny ways. So they have this almost internal kind of reaction. So again, it's drawing people's attention, heightening that kind of awareness, not just through the senses, but how our internal organs, our internal bodies is responding to the artwork.
What like considering just how important art is, what is lost, by not, do you feel that that a lot is actually, we're losing a lot by not creating pathways for people who do experience the world differently to create it and experience it and be a part of that world?
I think, I mean, historically, well, in recent history, I mean, in cave art, was, I would imagine, pretty accessible, but that's 70,000 years ago. It was there to be enjoyed, and I mean, interestingly, the cave art is produced in places, or the frequency of artworks in caves is in very specific acoustic parts of the caves that have very particular acoustic properties. So again, there's a multi-sensory thing going on 70,000 years ago when we were making art of buff drawings of buffaloes or the like. In recent times, the British Museum, for example, you had to be of a certain, you had to write a letter and be approved to be allowed in. So you had to be of a certain social status to be permitted to even consider looking at this, to be considered to be allowed to look at the stuff. So what we're really keen to do is just to open that up again and democratize it, and again and try not to make access into being for those people that need it. It's something that's opening up and enriching the experience for everyone.
And when does the exhibition open, the Beyond the Visual exhibition? When's the open date?
It opens on 28th of November of this year, 2025, and it runs right the way through to 19th of April in 2026. So that's fantastic. It's on for a long time, so people can visit and then they can go back. Again, going to this kind of temporal aspect, I mean, you might want to, just visit for a certain time and experience some of the works and then go back to experience the others. It's free for the public. There's no charge, which is again really important for us. And there's also a publication edited by Aaron and myself called also Beyond the Visual, Multi-Sensory Modes of Beholding Art, which is published by UCL Press. If you go to UCL Press,
We'll, yeah, we'll put a link to it on
section.
the show description.
The book is also free to download. It's open access. It's compatible with all types of readers, so it's very accessible, highly accessible, which is one of the reasons we went to UCL Press. So yeah, so we as well as the exhibition, you can access into 23 chapters. The majority of contributors to the publication are also blind or partially blind. And so this will open up the discussion. There's a chapter by Maria Oshodi talking about theatre. There's a chapter that talks about architecture, both from Jos Boys and the Architecture Beyond Sight project. There's chapters by Georgina Cleage. There's chapters by writers. There's installation art in there. There's all sorts of different kind of ways of engaging. So that opens up the discussion and is a really important part of the project.
And also during the exhibition, we're going to be having a number of events, which will include bringing some of the artists into to host workshops, talks, tours of the exhibition. But there's also the four galleries at the Henry Moore Institute, which we're taking over. But we've also There's a seminar room, which is quite a reasonable gallery space, and there'll be a permanent audio described as artist films reel, which will have a number of audio described artist films, and that's something that's kind of quite unusual. Artists, when they make films, very often just don't have the resources to have them described. So in this case, we've some work that. Well, Ken's made, and Ken and I have made, and a number of others have made.
So
Will
they're
be,
being,
will be. Sorry,
yeah.
let me go.
We have a piece by Carmen Papalia, who's a very well-known blind artist, passionately committed to disability justice. He's made a work about an extension of his mobility device, where he's replaced his white cane with a whole band, and he's performed this work in a number of places where the band becomes a substitute kind of mobility device that alerts him where he is in space. So, if he's walking into a road, the tuba in the band suddenly, brass band suddenly plays a note that kind of warns him that he's got to stop or turn right, etc. So There's an element of humour in some of the works. Van der Vee will have a film showing, as well as the work she has in the kind of gallery space. Joe Bannon, who again is a partially blind artist based in London, will have a work called Passing, audio described work in the seminar space showing. So it's a fantastic opportunity to expand those range of blind and partially blind artists who we're foregrounding within the exhibition.
And if any of our Australian listeners wanted to found them happen to find themselves in England over the next few months, where would they find the gallery?
It's in Leeds. Leeds is a town in Yorkshire, city, sorry, in Yorkshire. Everyone coming from Leeds will be horrified. It's kind of about midway. It's 2 hours on the train from London, north of London. It's very easy to get to from London. Also has a Leeds Art Gallery, as well as the Henry Moore Institute. Also Yorkshire Sculpture Park is very close to get to from Leeds. You can get a train to Wakefield and then a bus. It's in a fantastic kind of location, a beautiful landscape around.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Ken and Aaron, for joining us on Brainwaves. It was a pleasure to, learn from you, and I hope our listeners also sort of change their perspective on how they might approach art in the future, or hopefully, think about, how limiting it has been when it comes to incorporating multiple senses and also our sense of space.
Thank you so much. It's been a
Thank
pleasure.
you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
Great.
I good luck with the opening. It sounds really exciting. And thank you so much for joining us on Brainwaves.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you for joining us for this evening's episode of Brainwaves. We hope you enjoyed hearing from Professor Ken Wilder and Dr. Aaron McPeak. You can find more of our shows on our website at brainwaves.org.au or on the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au. Feel free to send us any feedback or suggestions for shows via email at brainwaves@wellways.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next Wednesday at 5 p.m. for another episode of Brainwaves on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.